Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show, Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. On today's show, Ian Paisley Jr. told us why he loves motorbikes. We also asked foreign correspondents what they thought about the way that Britain is seen around the world. But in today's episode, we take a look at what it's really like to work in Downing Street and why Boris Johnson might be trying to move his office elsewhere. Boris Johnson is leaving number 10. No, not like that. He remains in power, of course, but he is looking at moving his office out of Downing Street as part of efforts to beef up his control across Whitehall departments. Last week, the Prime Minister turned up in the Cabinet Office's Economic and Domestic Affairs Secretariat, where Dominic Cummings has already been seen waving a rolled-up floor plan of the building, marching around, measuring the curtains. Indeed. It's a bit of a turnaround because earlier this year, I reported in the Times that Dominic Cummings had tried to move the PM out of his number 10 den into a NASA-style command and control centre in number 12 Downing Street, into the same room, in fact, where Gordon Brown had created his own horseshoe-shaped bunker. And Boris Johnson refused to budge. But with coronavirus revealing the shortcomings of the government machine, apparently the PM is now ready to think the unthinkable and may well move out of number 10, or at least move his offices and some of his team. Number 10, of course, is a strange mix of the Prime Minister's home, office and official residence for entertaining world leaders. In a moment, we'll hear from two former Downing Street officials about what it's like to work behind that famous black door and previous attempts to modernise the PM's working conditions. But first, I've been speaking to Jack Brown, former historian in residence in Downing Street, about how the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland ended up working in a pokey terrace house.
It is a pokey terrace house, I will accept that, but it's a wonderful pokey terrace house. Short answer to your question is through complete accident, really. Downing Street houses were built in the 1680s by a guy called Sir George Downing, who was a diplomat, is the nice way of putting it. He was a spy later on. He was a serial traitor, not a guy who's got a great reputation. Built the houses very cheaply to a low standard, and the idea was that he was going to turn a profit, rent them out, or have people live in them, you know, who were no one in particular, you know, anyone who would pay. They weren't meant to be the home of anyone particularly special, but wouldn't have even been dreamed of that they'd be the home of the British Prime Minister when they're constructed. However, when Downing dies, just shortly after he started constructing the houses, again in the 1680s, the land reverts back to the Crown. And in the early 1700s, the King decides to give the land and the property to his favourite minister. At the time, there was no such thing as a prime minister, and this guy even denied explicitly being a prime minister because it was seen as a sort of an insult in a collective system of government. There wasn't meant to be one person who was the prime minister, but he clearly was the prime minister. It's a guy called Sir Robert Walpole, and the king gives him the property. He decides to accept it only in his official capacity as First Lord of the Treasury, which is a role that in modern times is synonymous with that of Prime Minister. So that's how it comes to be. Mostly The reason why Walpole only accepted it in his official capacity was because he didn't want to pay for the repairs that were necessary. And so when he accepts it as part of the job, he gets the state to pay for it. And ever since then, we've been trying to fix it.
Very, very wise. And before we get to the various states of repairs that it's gotten in the past, there's also 10 Downing Street, perhaps one of the most famous doors in the world. 11 Downing Street is where the Chancellor obviously lives. 12 Downing Street has traditionally been where the whips live, has since been taken over by the press office. But where is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8?
Gone, in effect. It was a whole row of terraced houses that were kind of knocked together. Like I said, number 10 itself was knocked together with a house at the back, which is much more impressive. So number 10 goes back a lot further than you would expect if you're looking from Downing Street at that famous front door, whereas numbers 11 and 12 don't. But the rest of the houses have all been kind of long gone. You have 70 Whitehall next door now, which is where the Cabinet Office is based, and where I believe Mr. Cummins has been spotted wandering around, right, checking it out for a potential move. That links to number 10 internally through a really famous green baize door that splits the Prime Minister's office from the Cabinet Office. And that's kind of, historically, that's been a really important distinction.
And what about the building itself? It fell into a state of disrepair, didn't it, back in the 60s?
Well, ever since it was constructed, Matt, like I say, it's two houses knocked together, number 10, and I mentioned earlier, you know, Walpole not wanting to pay for that himself. But there's something called the Great Repair that happens just a couple of decades after Walpole moved in. And there's a kind of series of bodge jobs and repairs around the edges of the building ever since it becomes home and office to the Prime Minister. It's particularly in a bad state after the Second World War, and there's some bomb damage done that doesn't help things, including a barrage balloon, you know, which cuts loose and takes some of the tiles off the roof. So there's a bit of friendly fire there as well. But the place is falling apart on its own accord, and it's in the 60s that it gets so dangerous that there's a serious risk that the Cabinet might be meeting one day and the Cabinet table will go through the floor. They're paying someone full-time to be on site as a fire safety officer because it's catching light left, right and centre. And they've got an on-site carpenter because the walls keep moving about so much that sometimes you can't open some of the doors or windows. So it's in a really bad state by the 60s, and that's when they decide to rebuild it.
The front of the house as well was a bit precarious, wasn't it?
The most of the walls and the floors are kind of out of true, you know, built on shaky foundations on marshy land. It all kind of moves about quite a lot. But the front wall is basically falling over into Downing Street. The top is a lot closer to Downing Street than the bottom. So it's kind of leaning forwards. It looks like the house is going to fall over. I'm not sure if you can physically see that, but if you measure it, it's quite alarming. So it's a good idea to rebuild it then, even though, you know, we're British and we don't want to interfere with history. But, you know, you also can't have the Prime Minister burning to death in the building.
And then what happened? Obviously, Prime Ministers, politicians, they hate to be seen to be spending money on themselves. It gets delayed and delayed and delayed. But eventually the work is done. How does that work go?
It runs substantially over time and over budget. It's hit by strikes as well. Macmillan doesn't want to be seen. Macmillan is the Prime Minister at the time, doesn't want to be seen to be spending a huge amount of money on it. And also doesn't want to go out for a survey. So he has them survey it over a weekend and they can't really properly investigate. And when they start the building works, they realise, God, this place is in a worse state than even we, you know, than our worst nightmares. It is literally falling apart.
Almost every building job that's ever happened in history, at some point, the builder declares it's much worse than we thought. And what happened with the famous outside of the building? Because obviously the image that everyone is picturing right now is the famous black door and the walls are black all around. But why is that?
Yeah, well, if you look at photos from sort of the 1920s, early 20th century, you'll see that the walls are effectively black, but it looks a bit inconsistent. And this is because they're black with soot. And this is just a classic feature of a London townhouse at the time. London, very sort of a smoggy, gritty, dirty place. And when they rebuilt it, they discovered that this was in fact soot and it was not a deliberate move. But they decided, okay, a sort of homage to that legacy, we're going to paint it black. And it actually looks quite deliberately and quite beautifully black now. The building itself is very higgledy-piggledy. It's got all these add-ons and different bits, and then you've got this building at the end that's a different colour. It really sort of conveys the historical nature of it, the fact that it is, like the British Constitution in some ways, just kind of a case of muddling through and making all the adaptations here and there as you go. You know, I think there is something particularly British about that.
And so how has it changed on the inside? How have Prime Ministers adapted it to suit them?
Historically, the Prime Minister would work in the cabinet room. Certainly in the post-war years, this was true. And next door, you'd have your private secretaries, and they would basically be the funnel for all your information. Everything ends up in there, in trays, and then it works its way through that kind of filtration process into the Prime Minister's red boxes. And that's kind of how it's always worked. But Tony Blair moved next door, moved out of the cabinet room and moved next door. Some prime ministers have preferred to work upstairs, slightly further away from the civil service and from their advisors. So, but in terms of like how prime ministers left their personality on the building, I mean, Thatcher's the one that you can see the most of, other than Churchill. Churchill has two portraits in there. There's a grand staircase that's really famous, lined with all the portraits of former prime ministers, and Churchill's the only one who has two. But Thatcher was someone who was there for long enough and at the right time that she could change some of the decor. And so there's a very blingy room upstairs used for entertaining where Thatcher's influence can be seen, because she felt it should be a bit grander. She felt that if you're entertaining, I won't name any names, but a world leader, there were world leaders that she liked more than others, but that they should be a little bit intimidated, really. They should be like, wow, Britain, a serious country. They shouldn't be walking around going, oh, this is very humble. I respect you very much for that, but, you know, I'm not very intimidated. She projected she used it to project power, and that's something you can still see in some of the state rooms upstairs. But I guess you make it work. One of the things that's incredible about number 10, it is very small, and the kind of office around the Prime Minister in terms of the staff, but also who you have access to, has kind of shaped to fit the building over the years. And that's why if there is to be a move away from number 10 at some point in the future, it could have potentially quite a direct and interesting ramifications for the type of centre that we have at the heart of government, of the type of office the Prime Minister has, and of how they actually run their government. So much of it comes from the fact that you've got this tiny little building with this weird layout that's the result of hundreds of years of minor adaptations here and there to stop it falling apart. And, you know, if we were to change that, it would be in a big moment of change, actually, for the way that we're governed.
If you like what you're hearing, you can listen to the whole of my Times Radio show, either listen back on the Times Radio app, or you can listen live Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. We'll have more on the episode after this.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's that was Jack Brown there, whose book Number 10, The Geography of Power at Downing Street, is a really brilliant, fascinating guide to the history and workings of the building. So let's now talk to two people who've worked in Number 10 and know what it's really like. Jonathan Powell was Chief of Staff to Tony Blair for his entire decade as Prime Minister. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. And Gabby Burton, now Baroness Burton, was Press Secretary and later Director of External Relations for David Cameron. Morning, Gabby.
Good morning.
Gabby, start us, first of all, what's it like going into Number 10 as a place of work?
Well, it's obviously kind of amazing, really. You get to walk up the road to one of the most famous addresses probably in the world, aside from the White House. You get to go behind the black door and you have a desk, as Jack Brown said, in one of the most historic buildings there is. And so it is... rather marvellous. But on the face of it, it's very prestigious. But obviously, in, like with so many things in life, the reality is a little bit less so. I can remember having to lift my feet up to let the mice go by. And I was one of the lucky ones. I was above ground. You know, so many people were working in offices that were once, you know, cupboards under the stairs. So it's right that it's a pretty rambling office. And I have no, there's no doubt in my mind that the reason why coronavirus spread to so many important people in government is because you cannot socially distance in number 10. It's just too, it's too close an environment.
Is that your experience as well, Jonathan? A weird place to work?
Yeah, it's completely inappropriate place to try and run a government from. I suggested when we first moved in, actually, back in 97, that we should not move in at all, but go to the QE2 centre and try and work out of there. We had people working out of bathrooms, people stacked five to a tiny room. It's just really daft to try and administer a government from a building that was not made for that at all.
So talk us through, yeah, this idea of moving the operations to the QE2 conference centre, which is a short walk from Downing Street. How would that have worked in practice? Would it become a sort of essentially like a whole new government department, the department of the Prime Minister?
Well, you wouldn't need to necessarily change its departmental structure at all. You just rent, the QE2 centre belongs to the government. You just rent a floor of that and make that where you do your office. You can have open plan offices. You have an office for the Prime Minister. It would just make life a whole lot easier. But I never got very far because Prime Ministers always like to work out of that and like to have the number 10 front door for people to go through. I remember we looked at moving out again because the building became completely unsustainable later on in Tony Blair's time. The building inspectors came to us saying the electric riser was about to burst into flames. So much power was coming through it that they couldn't guarantee the building. So we started looking at moving out. And of course, this was towards the end and Gordon Brown was looking forward to moving in. And he absolutely vetoed us doing any moving out because he thought it was a coup to stop him ever being able to occupy number 10. But we stayed on despite the danger.
Too much power in number 10 is often a complaint, but not so literally coming through the electric wires. Gabby,
we tried to do something much less ambitious. We tried to actually move back to, as Jack Brown said, getting the Prime Minister out of this tiny little den that they work out of and up to one of the state rooms. And that proved, the bill came in for that. And because it's a listed building, of course, it was huge. And we were about to do, as you know, a big austerity drive. And we felt that it just wouldn't go down well. But I think this is a huge opportunity and they probably should take it. Not least because there's so much talk now about how we need much more joined up government. Government works in silos. We know that putting the pandemic aside, the big societal issues that we're trying to sort of tackle, be it knife crime, domestic abuse, you need to have a sort of a proper cross-government approach. And if you were to redesign how government was run from the centre, then you have half a chance of actually doing that for real rather than just talking about it.
Is now the time in the middle of a crisis the time to do that, though, Jonathan? There's a risk, isn't there, of sort of trying to solve a problem. It's difficult to solve a problem when you're in the middle of the problem.
Yeah, you can't. I don't see how you could move out in the middle of the coronavirus crisis. They've already made such a horlicks of it that they won't want to do something that makes things even worse. So I doubt they would seriously do that. And I suppose that's why they're looking at trying to expand into the Cabinet Office, because the Cabinet Office is joined on. We talk about a green baize door, but it's actually an electronic door. And you can actually have multiple doors if you wanted into the Cabinet Office. And again, we looked at trying, in fact, we did put some of our units into the Cabinet Office, but the Cabinet Secretary regularly resists in very strong terms and tries to hang on to his turf, and the Cabinet Office Minister likewise is not keen to give up his grand office. Gabby talked about how small the den the Prime Minister works from. It's a lot bigger than where we put Tony first when we moved in. In 1997, we had Tony working in the old Marcia Faulkender room, which is a tiny room that looks over the garden. We couldn't think where else to put it. But there was no way of stopping people going in and out. There's no room outside, no place for a desk, and people just wander in. So we eventually moved him into the Private Secretary's room, which now become the den. Mrs. Thatcher and Harold Wilson both worked upstairs, what we call the boudoir, which is a very sort of elaborate room with its own toilet at the end of the room. But we didn't want to put up. We also looked at moving Tony into the white room, one of those staterooms. But again, we couldn't see how it could be done and what would you do when you're entertaining there. It's really a very difficult building to work your way around.
But Jonathan's right. You could, the fact that the Cabinet Office and Number 10 are so close, and essentially they are the same building, because one of the things that we should have done, and actually I think David Cameron regrets doing it, is not making the Cabinet Office and Number 10 work closer together, because you would avoid they are two seats of power, as Jonathan says, and if you brought them together, actually, there would be a more effective government generally. There wouldn't be two heads of the snake, as it were. They would probably do things better.
Just to talk us through the baize door, because someone's actually just texted in saying that the crucial thing about the door that connects the number 10 to the Cabinet Office is that number 10 staff have a pass, which means they can go through, but Cabinet Office staff don't, and they have to walk round and go up the road. Is that right?
You can get trapped in that. It's like a sort of plastic, you know, you kind of go into the, you go into a sort of, like in the Austin Powers film, and occasionally your pass doesn't work, and you can sort of find yourself sort of
stuck in the airlock.
Security to let you out.
And
I
was going to say, so is it so sort of hotly contested? You know, who gets to go through which door, and you know who's got the best office, all that stuff that really does matter. Even with the people at the top of the tree,
it matters particularly to them. It's you just have to look at Yes Prime Minister and Yes Minister, which is all about that. So particularly Yes Prime Minister, obviously. And it's the same thing now, as Robin Butler used to say, Yes Prime Minister is actually a documentary, not a comedy at all. When we moved into number 10 in 97, the crucial question was where people sit, because proximity to the Prime Minister is power. So everyone wanted to sit next to him. And you have to persuade some people that maybe the policy unit doesn't have to be right next door, it has to be a bit further away, maybe the press office needs to be further away, and so on. And it really becomes quite an elaborate negotiation. Unless you do it when you first move in, it's absolutely impossible. It's a bit like Security Council seats, permanent seats in Security Council. You can't get rid of people once they're on there. And it's the same. Once you've got them in an office, they're going to fight to the death. You'll actually literally have to pull them out with their fingernails.
It's like sort of the German sort of, towels on the desk. I mean, it was quite... I can remember people were putting their shoes underneath desks to try and reserve them and all the rest of it. So it does get a bit undignified.
Was that Steve Hilton? Was he...
he was sort of obviously took a totally different approach. Actually, the thing that Steve tried to do when he first came in, which caused outrage and nearly a massive walkout, was he wanted to reform the lovely cafe, which is probably the most secure cafe in the world, which is in the basement of number 10. And he wanted to turn it into something ridiculous, like a smoothie bar. And that there was absolutely no way he was getting that. So.
That didn't exist when we moved in. There was no way you could get food in Downing Street at all. It was absolutely impossible. So we had to actually build that at one stage, so there was some food. People used to have to go out.
That was a great addition, Jonathan.
Probably the greatest innovation we made, yeah, in government. We used to try and do things like order pizza. When I had Sinn Féin in negotiating, we'd try and order pizza, but the security people had to check the pizza so carefully that it was cold by the time it came in. It was really hard to get food, and of course the government marches on its stomach, so it's very hard to run.
And looking ahead in terms of, you know, Boris Johnson trying to rethink and taking over the Cabinet Office and all that sort of thing, does it matter being in the building that people know so well? Like you said, it's the most famous address, it's the most famous door, meeting people on the steps of Downing Street is so important, rather than going into a sort of, slightly plainer, modern office environment. Does it matter where people are making those decisions?
Well, I think if Jonathan's right, I mean, if the Prime Minister's in the Cabinet Office in a rather sort of modern glass, walled building, then that's where everyone wants to be. And suddenly it's the sort of the place where nobody wants to be in number 10 if the power has shifted. So I think that's probably a hurdle you can get over. But it's probably Boris Johnson, a man who loves his history, who will be the biggest roadblock to it, I imagine.
Do you think the same?
The problem's also the door. People want to go through the front door. So it doesn't, in a way, it's rather funny. You could move the office almost anywhere as long as you had to go through the front door of Downing Street. That's where world leaders want to be photographed.
But of course, there's no question that world leaders wouldn't meet. You'd have a sort of a phony office, as it were, in number 10. And you'd, of course, welcome world leaders. It still exists. But you could just have all the sort of the people working in another place. I think there are quite a few European countries that do that.
Yeah, you come in through the door, then you have a sort of 20-minute walk round the corridors before you get to
the... But you'd still have the meetings.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
We actually did look at trying to do that when we had to have the building works, so we just have a long corridor. But the trouble was then the security people get upset about having to bring the Prime Minister from somewhere else to the meetings there, and you'd break up the Prime Minister's day in such a way you couldn't get any work done. So there are all sorts of problems when you start to look at this in practice.
Because remember, the Prime Minister has an office in Parliament as well. So you're right, you don't want too many different bases, otherwise you spend your life sort of just travelling around.
Yeah, leaving paperwork in the wrong office and that sort of thing. What's the best and worst thing then about working in number 10, Gabby?
Oh my goodness. Look, the best is that you have an opportunity, if you do your job right, to actually make a difference. Question mark whether how much difference you make, but you are sitting in history. I mean, I used to love being, you know, the phrase, if these walls could talk, is never so true as in number 10. I mean, the worst, I suppose, is never being able to try and find anyone. If you try and sort of have a face-to-face with someone, just, you know, on the off chance, without organising a meeting, because it is such a rabbit warren, you can walk. I can remember being heavily pregnant, practically giving birth at the top of sort of several flights of stairs, trying to find this person, only to discover they were downstairs in the cafe. So it's just, as Jonathan said at the beginning, it's not really a functional office at all, because it's just too much of a rabbit warren.
Jonathan, is that the worst part of the building?
No, the worst part of the building is when we moved Tony into the old private office, we then had to move out into what was called the duty clerk's room, which is sort of next to it, the outer private office. And it takes some imagination to imagine quite how antiquated that is. You have a duty clerk sitting at one end of the room, as an official who's there the whole time, and a little wooden dumb waiter. And all the papers come in downstairs to what we call the garden rooms, and they're brought up by this dumb waiter by a hand pulley into the room. And then you've got six people sitting there, because everyone wants to sit next to the Prime Minister, and you have to have the diary secretary and the foreign affairs advisor wants to be there. And it's almost impossible to work in those circumstances. How can you have a private conversation, or how can you really think? So that's the problem. It's the sort of all being squeezed in together. And you get the same thing in the White House, where everyone wants to be in the West Wing, not in the old executive office building. You can have an office the size of a tennis court in the old executive office building, or a broom cupboard under the stairs in the White House, and they all want to be in the White House. The best thing about the place is the garden. Tony Blair was a sun worshipper and loved to have meetings out there, sitting in the sun, staring up at the sun. And he used to particularly inflict it on the poor old unionists. So when the unionists would come in, David Trimble, etc., very buttoned up in three-piece suits, they would have to sit sweltering in the sun while he sunned himself, trying to persuade them to sign up to an agreement with Sinn Féin. But their garden has a lot going for it.
And of course, nowadays, maybe you know, given social distance and all that, holding all the meetings in the garden would make much more sense, never mind moving the office to the Cabinet Office. Listen, I could speak to you for ages about this. Absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for that. It was Jonathan Powell, former Chief of Staff to Tony Blair, and Gabby Burton, who was Press Secretary and later Director of External Relations with David Cameron, talking us through this idea of Boris Johnson potentially moving his offices out of Downing Street and into the Cabinet Office. Dominic Cummings marching around with a floor plan of the offices as he sort of measures up the curtains to make all that happen, because it turns out trying to run a government from a sort of slightly pokey rabbit warren of corridors and a terraced house in London doesn't always work. But in the end, people just want to be as close to the guy in charge as much as possible. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box podcast. You can now listen back to my whole show on the Times Radio app, where you can also now listen to all of the Times podcasts, including Red Box 2. Make sure you subscribe and review at the Red Box podcast wherever you listen. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.